had gathered and were very eager to hear of the pastimes, of the activities of Krishna. And Suta Goswami was speaking to them. And after he had answered their question about the birth and the activities of Maharaj Prickett, of the great king Maharaj Prickett, how he had checked Kali, confusion and quarrel, from his kingdom, how he had rescued the religious principles embodied by Dharma, the bull of religiosity, how he had saved the earth from exploitation. And this was all due to Kali, the age of quarrel and confusion that so much wanted to influence, to spread its influence. But because of Maharaj Prickett's strength, it was impossible, virtually impossible for him to do so. But yet, the sages knew that Maharaj Prickett was cursed by the influence of Kali. Maharaj Prickett was cursed, and because of that curse, he ended up renouncing his kingdom and vowing to sit on the bank of the Ganges River and await his death. So for 7 days he did that. Now, because he was a very saintly person, he naturally wondered, he inquired very eagerly as to what would be the best thing for him to do during those 7 days as he was awaiting his death. So the sages knew that this was going to happen. They knew that Krishna himself had, basically speaking, organized a great war in which millions of people were killed for the purpose of establishing Yudhisthira, the great king, who was so righteous, for establishing this king, Yudhisthira, as the monarch, because so much depends on the quality of the government. When the government is good and is governing by religious principles, then the people naturally follow. The people naturally become good, because people are generally innocent. The people of the world, the common people, they are not bad, they are innocent. But under bad guidance, they certainly become bad. But if educated properly, shastrically, scripturally, as to the difference between good and bad, then naturally they can see clearly differentiate. Otherwise, people become led in the wrong direction. Someone placed, is this yours over here? Gave me a gift over here of some newspaper article. And it says, here's what it is. Here's a good example of being led in the wrong direction. And this is what goes on. The title of the article is, "Study says that sin in moderation is good for you." According to a new study of 4,000 quote sinners in 8 countries by Associates for Research into the Science of Enjoyment, which is an acronym that when you put it all together it comes to ARISE. According to the ARISE, smoking, drinking, avoiding exercise, indulging in chocolate and other food that tastes good versus health food, this is good for you, but only if you don't feel guilty. Arise says that if you really enjoy your indulgences, they will reduce stress and strengthen your immune system. So people, these are so many So much propaganda goes on.
Obviously, they feel good when they take those things.
They feel good. And after all, that is what counts, isn't it? Just like, for instance, if I don't like you, and I want to, why repress my anger and aggression? So I should kill you, and I'll feel very good about myself. After all, you might have stepped on my toe or something. And after all, if I feel good, what is better than that for the world? If I like the taste of cow meat, let me kill thousands of cows. Why? Because I feel good. I like it. And that reduces my stress. Now, maybe the cows are a little inconvenienced, but anyway, what's the difference? So if you have some money, you have some gold, you have something I want to feel good. Why should I feel guilty about wanting something that you have? For instance, your two ears. They would look very nice. That was very nice on my dresser, my chest of drawers. Would you please donate your ears to me? Thank you. You're lucky you donated them, because I was going to take them anyway. Because why should I be under any stress about repressing my desires? That will cause me anxiety, and that will do horrible things for my immunity, my immune system. So just imagine if there was one nut thinking like that, how intolerable would be for the world. But imagine if everyone was thinking about that, me, 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 and what's good for me is good for everyone else. Then the world becomes insane. And more or less, that is the definition of what's going on due to this type of propaganda. Because the leadership doesn't recognize truly what the difference between good and bad. So Krishna wanted to install Yudhisthira Maharaj as the king. Because when the king is personified goodness and fairness and representative of Krishna, then naturally the citizens make such advancement in spiritual life. But then, amazingly enough, just 30 years or so after Yudhisthira was the king and Krishna left, and then Yudhisthira immediately left, but he installed Parikshit Maharaj as the king. So, but after Parikshit Maharaj was the king for some time, Krishna had a plan, and we will hear what that plan is. But it is quite amazing that Krishna, after so much trouble, is taken to install this powerful king, Yudhisthira, to Parikshit Maharaj, to bring into power this powerful king. He has a plan to remove him from power and have him sit on the bank of the Ganges River and fast for 7 days until death. Having him, he is the one who is keeping Kali at bay to protect the citizens, and yet, amazingly enough, something happens to remove him. And one can only say this is Krishna's plan. So why Krishna does one thing that seemingly may not be good even, this is truly inconceivable, but we can understand that when Krishna does something, it is purposeful. And only good will ultimately come from it. So, in any case, the sages of Namasharanya who were listening to Suta Goswami speak, they were so happy to hear that about Maharaj Prickett's driving Kali from the kingdom. They wanted to hear more. They wanted to hear more about how Prickett Maharaj came to be cursed, came to give up the kingdom, came to sit down on the bank of the Ganges. And they requested to hear this Krishna Katha, these words about Krishna. They begged, practically speaking, they begged, Sutta, please tell us more about Krishna. We want to hear this. We never tire of hearing this. We never become satiated. We never think, oh, it's enough. Rather, we wish to have millions of ears so we could hear more and more and more. And millions of tongues that have the ability and desire to vibrate Krishna's names because it is increasing sweetness. So when they requested, the sages requested, and these people were already sages, and they were still so desirous of hearing about Krishna and the devotees of Krishna. So they requested Sutta to speak, and that is where we ended yesterday. Now, when Sutta, the first thing that Sutta Goswami does when he begins to speak, we'll read the first verse that he says, text 18. O Lord, O God, although we are born in a mixed caste, in other words, his birth wasn't of the highest, we are still promoted in birthright simply by serving and following the great who are advanced in knowledge. Even by conversing with such great souls, one can without delay cleanse oneself of all disqualifications resulting from lower births. What to speak of those? Because even talking or just by serving and following those great souls, the Mahat, Mahat Sevam, Dwaramaham Vimukte, just by serving those who are great in knowledge, it opens the door to liberation from the material world. And it elevates one so much, Sutta Goswami said. What to speak if just by serving them slightly? What to speak of those who are under the direction of the great devotees? Who are chanting under the direction of the great devotees, who chant the holy name of the unlimited, who has unlimited potency. How fortunate those souls are. And Sutta is saying that even myself, my own disqualifications, because again, he wasn't born in the highest of families, but my own disqualifications have been removed by this process. So he was speaking directly from his own experience. What to speak? Just by serving slightly even, it is so powerful. What to speak of those who directly are being guided by the great souls, and in that guidance they are chanting Krishna's holy names, his attributes, because he is Ananta. Ananta means the unlimited. So after describing, because he's encouraging the sages also to listen carefully. They already know the power of Krishna Katha. They themselves have just glorified it. So Sutta Goswami is explaining how powerful it is. It has uplifted me. It can uplift everyone. Why? Why is Krishna Katha so powerful? Because it is about Krishna. And who is Krishna? He is the Supreme Lord. And then, so in 21:22, he describes the glories of Krishna by saying, who can be worthy of the name of the Supreme Lord but the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna? And the water that washes his feet, because generally, water that washes somebody's feet, it is not considered, certainly is not considered suitable for drinking. It goes down the drain only, and that's what it's suitable for. But the water that washes the lotus feet of Krishna is so purifying. Rather than putting it down the drain, if someone takes that, he is so powerful and so great, the Supreme Lord is, that if someone takes that water and puts it upon his head, he is purified. And not only an ordinary person who does that is purified, but even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva are purified, the greatest of personalities. And then, interestingly enough, which has to do with Maharaj Prickett, in 22, self-controlled persons who are attached to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna can all of a sudden give up the world of material attachment, including the gross body and subtle mind, and go away to attain the highest perfection of the renounced order of life, by which non-violence and renunciation are consequential. This means that if someone gains attachment to this person, Krishna, who is a person, but although he's a person, he is not limited, because our concept of person is one who is limited, because we think that if he, a person means he has defined and specific characteristics and qualities. Person means that someone has a personality. If someone has a personality, he has characteristics. He has specific qualities. So how can someone who is specific be unlimited? So thinking like this, using a material conception of a person, people think, naturally enough, that the Supreme must be unlimited, because to give him qualities would limit him. But actually, to say that the Supreme cannot have qualities, that he cannot have a personality, that limits him. If he's unlimited, and if he explains that I am like this, I am like that, I have the quality of mercy, I have form, but that form itself is unlimited. So how can a form be unlimited? If it is in one place, if it has specific characteristics, can it be unlimited? Generally speaking, not. But in God's case, in Krishna's case, he inconceivably can do this. And to say that God can't be inconceivable limits him to our tiny brain. So to place some limitation on the Supreme, to say that he can't be a person, is truly limiting him. So he is a person, but an unlimited person. So if someone gains attachment, even if that attachment is slight, to this person, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, if someone somehow gains attachment and attraction to him, his qualities, Krishna's qualities, are so wonderful and so spiritually attractive and captivating, that if someone has even a drop of attachment to Krishna, such a person can immediately give up everything, suddenly, like that, in the material world, as inconsequential, because he has gained the great jewel of attachment to Krishna, which is compared to like billions and billions of dollars. And this verse describes, like, if someone has attraction to Krishna, it is like having a billion billion dollars, and he can instantaneously give up 1 cent, 2 cents, 5 cents, 100, anything. Because everything else compared to attraction to Krishna is considered, like, practically speaking, non-existent. It is useless. It is so insignificant it practically doesn't exist. And then, being carried by their attachment to Krishna, they can easily attain the highest perfection, which is that highest perfection is when our self, the soul, becomes fully immersed in love for Krishna. And when the temporary body dies, they will go to the eternal spiritual world, the Goloka Vrindavan, the place of Krishna, which is just what Maharaj Prickett did. So therefore Suta Goswami is describing, almost predicting what's going to happen, that people should not be despondent that this great king, Maharaj Prickett, who was a devotee of Krishna, he was not protected, he was cursed, and he had to give up everything and die within 7 days? No. Not unfortunate, but because of his great attachment to Krishna, he was able to give up everything as insignificant instantaneously, what to speak of in 7 days, and attain the highest perfection of renunciation, which is again attachment to Krishna, from the position of king. So how fortunate, because a king means he's involved in so much power, so much politics, so much wealth, so much friends, thinking in terms of friends and enemies, armies, wealth, opulence, this and that. But give it up. Carried by the potent power of attachment to Krishna. So then, Suta Goswami, just before he begins telling this wonderful pastime of Maharaj Prickett, he says, O rishis, in text 23, who are as powerful as the sun. Why are rishis or saintly persons compared to the sun? Because the sun gives light. And light is always compared to knowledge, and ignorance is compared to darkness. Because in darkness, even if our eyes are open, we can see nothing. But if we have knowledge, spiritual knowledge, which is compared to light, we can see things exactly as they are, in their correct perspective. In the dark, we stumble around, we trip, we fall, we bang our knees, we bump our head. But when there's light, everything becomes clear. So the sun is the giver of light, and similarly the rishis are compared to the sun, because a holy person, a rishi, a saintly person's business is to give light, to give knowledge. So he complimented them, recognizing their position, by saying, O rishis, you who are as powerful as the sun, I shall try to describe to you the transcendental pastimes of Vishnu as far as my knowledge is concerned. Because Krishna is called, as he explained, he is called Ananta. Ananta means again unlimited. So the pastimes of Krishna are unlimitedly deep. They're vast. And no one can describe them in fullness. But according to his own ability, Suta Goswami says, I will describe them according to my capacity. As the birds fly in the sky, as far as their capacity allows. We see that the parrots fly on one level, the great eagles and hawks fly on another level, the sparrows fly on another level, the pigeons fly on another level, the crows fly still on another level. Pelicans fly on, and every bird, according to its own personal power and potency, flies at its own height, with its own characteristics. So as birds fly in the sky as far as their capacity allows, so do the learned devotees describe the Lord as far as their realizations allow. But the sky itself is unlimitedly vast. So Suta Goswami very humbly begins to tell this pastime. Once upon a time, Maharaj Prickett, while engaged in hunting in the forest with bow and arrow, became extremely fatigued, hungry, and thirsty while following the stags. While searching for a reservoir of water, he entered the hermitage of a well-known sage, Samaka Rishi, And he saw the sage sitting silently with closed eyes. Hungry and thirsty, he entered the sage's hermitage, and he saw the sage sitting with matted hair that was unkemptly spread over his body. The sage was silent, practically not breathing, in deep meditation, samadhi. And actually the sage was experiencing at that time his own oneness with the Supreme. He was wearing only the stag of a deer. So Maharaj Prigit wandered into the hermitage, entered the kutir, the hut of the sage, and he looked at him and said, "My dear sage, I am so thirsty, I have been wandering around hunting. Could you please give me some water?" But the sage, who was enwrapped in his meditation, did not even notice that the king had arrived. And when a king arrives, there's a power, there's a potency, a powerful person has his own charisma. So he walked in, and the sage just simply continued meditating, unaware completely that the Maharaj, the king himself, had entered. The king, being very thirsty and hungry, asked for the water but didn't even receive a hello, a yes, a welcome. And Vedic etiquette is very strict like this. If someone comes to the door of your house, you don't open the peephole and gaze through and see who it is and then say, "What do you want?" No, immediately, "Please come in. You have come to my door. How kind of you to come. You please sit down. At least I may not have very much to offer you, but please at least sit down, take this straw mat, make yourself comfortable, take some water. At least that." Even an enemy, even an avowed enemy who comes to the door is treated like this. If they come to your house, there's no question of friend or enemy. There is only one thing, there's guest. "He has come to me. I must treat him with some kindness." Maharaj Prigit was not an enemy. He was an exalted personality and the king of the land. And the sage didn't even say hello to him. He didn't offer him a straw mat. He didn't offer him water. He didn't even offer him a kind word, a welcoming word. So Prigit Maharaj became angry. A great king, so powerful, so self-controlled, protected by Krishna. He became angry because he thought, "Because I'm a king and he's a sage, he thinks himself so much better than me that he won't even offer me a word or say hello to me. He won't even welcome me. He's insulted me, thinking me so inferior. He's insulted me. So I will insult him." So the king picked up a dead snake that was lying nearby by Krishna's arrangement. Everything was there for this pastime. The dead snake was there. He picked it up on the end of his bow and he put it around the neck of the sage. "So you have greeted me with a garland, with no garland, but I am not like you. I will give you a garland, but a garland of a dead snake." Then the king immediately walked out. Now, this is the beginning of the pastime. Now, Jiva Goswami, a great commentator, explained that Krishna wanted to bring Parikshit to him very quickly, back to the spiritual world. He wanted to inspire his full detachment from the world. And also, he wanted to set a circumstance in which the Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken. Because a king, while he's on the planet, will be able to protect the citizens. But the Srimad Bhagavatam is like the sun itself. Poranarko dunolditaha. It arises in Kali Yuga to dispel the darkness for anyone, the darkness of his ignorance, of anyone who reads it, to anyone who comes in contact with it. So Krishna wanted this Srimad Bhagavatam to be spoken. So he instituted a drama, more or less, using his dear devotee, Maharaj Parikshit. He instituted a drama. So the sage remained with a garland around his neck of a dead snake. And the king walked out. Soon as the king returned to his palace, he began to wonder, was the sage actually deep in meditation and didn't notice me? Or was he neglecting me, purposefully making believe he was in meditation just to get an excuse? Like sometimes we don't want to see someone, we look the other way and we, you know, make believe we're talking to someone or make believe we're engrossed in something else. Was the sage doing something like that to me? Because insulting me, thinking that he's a Brahmana, he's a holy person, I'm only a Kshatriya? Or was he really in meditation? So he immediately began to feel guilty about what he had done. Because this is the nature of a devotee, of a good person, of any good person, is when they do something improper, they immediately notice it in their own consciousness and they immediately recognize it and don't like it. It starts to bother them that they did something that incorrectly. So Prabhupada explains in the purport why Krishna arranged such a thing. The king, being a devotee of the Lord, did not approve of his own action. And thus he began to wonder whether the sage was really in a trance or was just pretending in order to avoid receiving the king, who was a Kshatriya and therefore lower in rank. Repentance comes in the mind of a good soul as soon as he commits something wrong. Usually, when we commit something wrong, rather than repentance coming in our mind, blaming everyone else is what comes into our mind. Well, he deserved it, and he did this, and he did this, and etc., etc. But that is not how a good soul acts. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Jiva Goswami do not believe that the king's action was due to his past misdeeds, because when one does something wrong, improperly, it means that this is his bad karma from past misdeeds. But they don't think that this was the cause of Maharaj Parikshit's acting improperly. The arrangement was so made by the Lord just to call the king back home, back to Godhead. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the plan was made by the will of the Lord. And by the will of the Lord, the situation of frustration was created. He was hungry and thirsty. The plan was that for his so-called misdeed, the king could be cursed by an inexperienced Brahmana boy infected by the influence of Kali. And thus the king would leave his hearth and home for good. His connections with Srila Sukadev Goswami would enable the presentation of the great Srimad Bhagavatam, which is considered to be the book incarnation of the Lord. This book incarnation of the Lord gives much fascinating information of the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, like his Rasa Leela with the spiritual cowherd damsels of Brajabhumi. This specific pastime of the Lord has a special significance because anyone who properly learns about this particular pastime of the Lord will certainly be dissuaded from mundane sex desire and be placed on the path of sublime devotional service to the Lord. The pure devotee's mundane frustration is meant to elevate the devotee to a higher transcendental position. By placing Arjuna and the Pandavas in frustration due to the intrigue of their cousin brothers, the prelude of the battle of Kurukshetra was created by the Lord. This was to incarnate the sound representative of the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita. So by placing King Parikshit in an awkward position, the incarnation of Srimad Bhagavatam was created by the will of the Lord. Being distressed by hunger and thirst was only a show, because the king endured much, even in the womb of his mother. He was never disturbed by the glaring heat of the Brahmastra released by Aswatthama. The king's distressed condition was certainly unprecedented. The devotees like Maharaj Parikshit are powerful enough to forbear such distresses by the will of the Lord, and they are never disturbed. The situation in this case was therefore all planned by the Lord. So that tells us what's going to happen and why it was going to happen. Krishna's plan is at work. And a devotee, a pure devotee, has full confidence in this. His faith and realizations are so deep that he understands that Krishna's plan is at work, and therefore I should never be in any anxiety about anything. No situation, whether it is heavenly or hellish, disturbs an exalted devotee, because everywhere he only sees Krishna. But in any case, the drama still had to be enacted. The sage had a son who was very powerful, being a Brahmana's son. While he was playing with inexperienced boys, he heard of his father's distress. His father was still in meditation, but he was wearing the snake garland around his neck, and the boy, whose name was Sringi, he heard of what had happened. The boy, who was young and inexperienced, but yet very powerful, said, "Oh, just look at the sins of the rulers, who like crows and watchdogs at the door, perpetrate sins against their masters, contrary to the principles governing servants." So he immediately exhibited pride. "I am a Brahmin, the son of a Brahmin, and this king, lower class, he should be outside the house like a dog is kept outside. A watchdog." So even though the Kshatriyas considered themselves the servants of the Brahmanas, Maharaj Parikshit was such an exalted personality, and plus, it is not proper to speak like this, so in such an insulting way. And he compared Maharaj Parikshit's going inside to ask for water to like a dog demanding to sit at the table and eat with his master off the same plate. He was a young, proud, inexperienced fellow, but powerful. After the departure of Lord Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead and supreme ruler of everyone, these upstarts have flourished, our protector Krishna having been gone. Therefore, I myself, this is the key to how the demonic nature works and how Kali Yuga works. Our colleagues and friends. I myself will do it. Krishna is not here, and who is second best? It is me. I will do everything myself. I will take everything into my own hands. So now that Krishna is gone, because Krishna has just departed from this world. I will take up this matter myself and I will punish him. Just see my power. In other words, pride has come. Confusion. Kali has brought confusion and pride. But he still has power. And we will see his power. The son of the Rishi, his eyes red hot with anger, touched the water of the river Kaushika while speaking to his playmates and discharged the following thunderbolt of words, a curse. On the seventh day from today, a snake bird, Takshakas, a snake bird will bite this most wretched one of that dynasty, of the kingly dynasty, because he has broken the laws of etiquette by insulting my father. I curse him to die, being bitten by a poisonous snake bird on the seventh day from today. So when the boy had done that with his full power, and he had that power, he returned to his father's hermitage and he saw the snake on his father's shoulder and he began to cry very loudly. Prabhupada explains in the purport why he began to cry. The boy was not happy because he committed a great mistake and he wanted to be relieved of the burden on his heart by crying. So after entering the hermitage and seeing his father in that condition, he cried loudly so that he might be relieved. But it was too late. The father regretted the whole incident. So due to the loud crying of the boy, the father's meditation was disturbed. And his eyes gradually opened as his meditation broke. And he saw the dead snake around his own shoulders and he threw it aside, thinking it as insignificant and inconsequential. And he asked his son, "Why are you crying? Has someone hurt you? What's happened?" The boy told his father what had happened, that he had cursed the king. And the father understood that this was completely inappropriate. And he began to lament, saying, "Alas, alas, what has happened? What a great sinful act, an unfortunate act has been performed by my son." He was not at all pleased by this because he knew the position of Maharaj Prickett as the protector of everyone, because that is the business of the king. And that his son, the son had given such a big punishment for something so small, insignificant, inconsequential, that his son had cursed him to die. So in verses 42 to 46, Samagrishi expresses his distraughtness over the act his son has done, because Maharaj Prickett, he was upholding the whole kingdom, the whole world practically, due to his strength and his piety. And now he would die? Then what would happen? So he said, "Oh my boy, your intelligence is immature. And therefore you have no knowledge that the king, who is the best amongst human beings, is as good as the personality of Godhead. He's never to be placed on an equal footing with a human being. The citizens of the state, they live in prosperity, protected by his unsurpassable power. And look what you have done. The kingdom is surviving due to him, and you have cursed him to die. For what? For nothing. My dear boy, Krishna, the Lord who carries the wheel of a chariot, is represented by the monarch, the king. And when this regime is abolished, the whole world becomes filled with thieves, who then at once vanquish the unprotected subjects like scattered lambs. He's telling them, this is what you're doing. This is what you have done. Due to the termination of the monarchical regimes and the plundering of the people's wealth by rogue and thieves, there will be great social disruptions. People will be killed and injured, and animals and women will be stolen. And all of these sins, for them we shall be responsible. And at that time, the people in general will fall systematically from the path of progressive civilization in respect of the vana and ashramas, the castes and the orders of society in the Vedic system. Thus, they will be more attracted to economic development. They will give up the proper principles of religiosity, and they will be only attracted to economic development for sense gratification. And what will be the result of that? Their degradation will increase, and they will become on the level of a dog or a monkey. And what's a monkey's only business? Monkey business. Wasting time, eating, sex, playing, stealing, ripping, jumping from this to that. And dog smelling, looking for a female dog, looking for something to eat. Humans will become like that. Humans have become like that. The sage continued, the Emperor Parikit is a pious king. He is highly celebrated and is a first-class devotee of the personality of Godhead. He is a saint amongst royalty, and he has performed many horse sacrifices. When such a king is tired and fatigued, being stricken with hunger and thirst, he does not at all deserve to be cursed. So this is what's happened, actually speaking. That because Kali, quarrel, entered and first affected this Brahmin boy, this shows, this is the beginning of the their power, but first they lose their sense of culture. They become proud and think that they are better than the Kshatriyas, better than everyone. And from that, they begin to exploit that pride. And then what happens when they think themselves better than the Kshatriyas? They lose their own standing, is what happens. Because sages, the Brahminical caste, they are meant to be extremely qualified with learning, power, etc., but also with deep humility. Because when one is truly learned, the result of that is humility. Because learnedness means understanding the Lord, understanding Krishna, and Krishna is Ananta. And no matter how learned a human being is, he's insignificant compared to Krishna. So pride automatically and actually means a forgetfulness of God and our relationship, our relative relationship with Him. When the Brahmana or the intellectual caste, the intellectually spiritual caste, is inflicted with Kali's influence, this is what happens. And then in time, because they think themselves better than the Kshatriyas, they begin to lord it over the Kshatriyas, the warriors. And if there's anything a warrior cannot tolerate, a Kshatriya cannot tolerate, it is someone thinking that they are better than him. They will happily, when they see Brahminical qualities of humility and learning, they will happily serve that person. But as soon as someone tries to exploit them, they cannot tolerate it. They have that mentality. So this can be traced, exactly what happened, just as The sage is saying what will happen is exactly what happened as you trace what happened in Kali Yuga. Due to the impurity of the Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas cast them off. And they said, we don't need you anymore. We will govern by ourselves. And when men of power just take over without the influence of the saintly Brahmanas who give them knowledge and spiritual direction, when the Kshatriyas, the warriors, cut themselves off from that, they become intolerable and oppressive. And become addicted to horrible sense gratification because they've lost the religious center of their lives. And this is what has just has happened. And not just has happened, but it's happened in Western civilization even. There was the feudal period where there were so many kingdoms like that. But when the kings become just sense gratifiers and just collect taxes, not caring about their citizens' welfare and not leading them religiously and properly, the result of that is that the people, the Vaishyas, the mercantile people who make money, they plot revolution. Because they figure, why should I give all the taxes to this person and he's exploiting things for his sense gratification? Therefore, they cause a revolution, and that revolution is called capitalism. When the Vaishyas, they organize society, when the Brahmins are organizing society, they work with the other elements of society, the other so-called castes, and then things have a religious center. When the Kshatriyas organize society, broken off from the Brahmanas, then things just have a center with power, brute power. And because that is unsatisfying and exploitive, then the Vaishyas plot their revolution. And what they start doing, and this is documented, when they get a lot of money, they think, why should I give it to the in taxes to the Kshatriyas? Rather, what I'll do is I'll give money to this set of Kshatriyas over here as a loan, and I'll give it to these over here as a loan, and then they both fight each other, and whoever wins owes me everything. And that way they begin to dominate. They begin to dominate over the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas become dependent on the money of the mercantile people, and that is capitalism. So what happens then is that the capitalists, because their business is economics only, they just exploit the poor people, put them in hellish factories, and try to give them as little as possible and try to make as much profit as they can. Then there is revolution amongst the workers, etc. And that was communism. And people, by this gradual degradation of society, people become like monkeys and dogs, thinking that the purpose of life is just economics and sex life and this petty enjoyment or that petty enjoyment. Animalistic, not understanding there is a spiritual purpose of life. So the king is saying, my son, due to the influence of Kali on you, look what you have started. This degradation will only continue. Because the Brahmins, it first infected the Brahmins. Then the sage continued. And there's a few more verses in the chapter. So we'll try to complete the chapter. After telling his son what would happen, he said in text 47, the Rishi prayed to the Lord, the all-pervading personality of Godhead, to pardon his immature boy who had no intelligence, who committed the great sin of cursing a person who was completely free from sin, who was subordinate, who deserved to be protected. So on one side, the king, the sage rather, prayed that the boy would be forgiven. But he knew that the proper reaction should be that the king would curse the boy back. He had that power. But he knew, the sage knew, that the king was a devotee and he would never do that. Because again, whatever occurs for a devotee, he accepts, as difficult as it may be, he accepts that Krishna's plan is involved in this and I see only my own faults. So therefore in text 40, he knew, the sage knew that Maharaj Prickett wouldn't retaliate in that way, remove the sinful reaction for the boy, and therefore he simply prayed that Krishna would forgive him. Now how did Maharaj Prickett react? The devotees of the Lord are so forbearing that even though they are defamed, cheated, cursed, disturbed, neglected, or even killed, they're never inclined to avenge themselves. The consciousness of a devotee, a deep and pure devotee, is very difficult to understand, because actually, although he may appear to be in the material world, he's living in his relationship with Krishna. That is reality to him. And his dealings in the material world are like, as we said, a drama. Just like if you're in a drama. And in the drama, your part is someone gives you $1,000,000. Or in your part, you get your head cut off and you have to lie down dead in the drama. But it's a drama. It's a play. It's temporary. You know that when the curtain closes, you have to give back the $1,000,000, or you just get up from, and you have to pull the fake knife out of your heart, and then you get up and walk away. You have a real life. And the drama life is not your real life. Some people, if they go crazy, they start identifying with their part in the drama. And they forget that it's a drama. They think this is it. This is the real thing. So that's our material life. It is just a drama. And the material body is a costume we have put on. Well, we are something else. We are eternal souls. And we have a real life in relationship with Krishna. But we have gotten mad and forgotten that. So the great devotees, they don't identify with their body. They don't identify with the drama that's going on. They are living, actually awake and alive to their relationship with Krishna. And there's so much pleasure in that. Just like if a person, he's getting in the drama, he gets the knife in the heart and he's lying there. Or he's leading up to that part. But right after the curtain goes down, he has an appointment with his dear most beloved friend. So while he's going through his lines and his part, and people are staring at it in disbelief and are crying when he gets there, he's just thinking, oh, when is this going to be over so I can go on end the drama part. I want to go. I want to see my friend. I love my friend. And we're going to do this together and we're going to do that together. He's that awake. The devotee is that awake to his relationship with Krishna. So therefore, they are so forbearing that even though they are defamed, cheated, cursed, disturbed, neglected, or even killed, they're never inclined to avenge themselves. The sage thus regretted the sin committed by his own son. He did not take the insult paid by the king very seriously. We'll just read Prabhupada's purport to text 49. The whole incident is now cleared up. Maharaj Prickett's garlanding of the sage with a dead snake was not at all a very serious offense. But Sringi's cursing the king was a serious offense. The serious offense was committed by a foolish child only. Therefore he deserved to be pardoned by the Supreme Lord. although it was not possible to get free from the sinful reaction. Maharaj Prickett also did not mind the curse offered to him by a foolish Brahmana. On the contrary, he took full advantage of the awkward situation, and by the great will of the Lord, Maharaj Prickett achieved the highest perfection of life through the grace of Srila Sukadeva Goswami. Actually, it was the desire of the Lord, and Maharaj Prickett, Rishi Shamika, and his son Sringi were all instrumental in fulfilling the desire of the Lord. So none of them were put into difficulty because everything was done in relation with the Supreme Person. So it was all a drama actually going on. So that this Bhagavatam would be spoken, so that Maharaj Prickett would be brought quickly back to the lotus feet of the Lord. It was a drama. So then in the final verse of this chapter, and tomorrow, not tomorrow, but next week, we'll begin, and if Krishna allows, we'll complete the final chapter in this canto. The final verse in this chapter is just a post-thought on this. Generally, the transcendentalists, even though engaged by others in the dualities of the material world, are not distressed, nor do they take pleasure in worldly things, for they are transcendentally engaged. Externally, they are doing one thing, but inside they are fully awake with their relationship with Krishna. So that always has to be kept in the perspective of why Krishna has allowed this to happen to his great devotee, Maharaj Prickett. So on one level, something unfortunate has happened, and we have to feel bad that this great protector of society is being removed from his position. Cursed, unfortunate, improper activity. But on the other level, we see this is Krishna, Krishna's actions. So we, when we study this, we are being trained to not only see this in Maharaj Prickett's life, but to also see Krishna's own desires being active in our own lives and try to make ourselves more malleable to what Krishna's desires are, as Maharaj Prickett became fully malleable, fully surrendered and submissive to Krishna's desires, even though they were so extreme in his case. From king to 7 days to live. From complete success to the end. So extreme. So we are being instructed also how to do this and thereby gain the perfection that Maharaj Prickett also gained by fully focusing his consciousness on Krishna up to the very end of his life and thereby going back home, back to Godhead. And that is what we are learning how to do. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments? Another minute left.
Why in this situation, even though you not see it, I should do whatever I can to convert, because I have to maintain this body in such many steps.
Because he recognized that Krishna's desire was inherent in this. Mm-hmm. I think in the beginning that's the next chapter that comes up, and he recognized it as Krishna's sort of tap on the shoulder. Krishna awoke him to seeing this in a particular way, and that was Krishna's desire. He was inspired to see only his own fault because he could have counter cursed it. Remember, the sages were wondering why is it that Krishna didn't protect him, because he protected him even in the womb. So Krishna was fully capable of protecting him, and Maharaj Prickett knew that. So he recognized that Krishna is arranging this for me, so therefore I should just accept. Ultimately, that's what he was thinking.
Certainly, he was not drinking any of the four.
what is the fifth one?
The stacking bowl.
Oh.
So, how did God influence him?
Pride. But the result of those things, or even gold, one of the results is pride. And that's what happens when one is very wealthy. You immediately get proud. I don't need anyone. I'm better than everyone. So somehow or another, this was a little door left open. And also, Kali cheats. He goes where he's not invited also.
In that sense, in the time of Maharaj Yudhishthira itself, even prior to that there was pride, and Dhritarashtra had pride. That means Kali was present.
Certainly illusion was present. But Kali, there was always illusion. This is the material world, there is always illusion present. But through the door of the pride of this Brahmin boy, and that pride was in lack of culture, really. That's how Kali entered, specifically.
It is also said that
yes.
Since Maharaj Parikshit was wearing a gold crown, Kali was sitting in the gold crown.
Where is it said that?
Okay. As soon as he went back to his kingdom, his house, he took the crown off and he realized, oh, what I have done. So Kali is working there also in there. It's a drama.
And ultimately, the question was raised, we spoke about this yesterday, why didn't Prickett Maharaj kill Kali? Because there's Krishna's desire that Kali Yuga comes, because this is the cycle of Yugas. Kali must come. Yeah. He could have. Why not? Arjuna broke Kshatriya principles on Krishna's order. You didn't see him, but that doesn't mean that Krishna wasn't there. You had a question? Last question.
Couldn't Srini have taken back his
kingdom? Yes. Or Samik Rishi could have broken it, or Maharaj Prickett could have broken it.
But Samik Rishi, understanding that he'd done something very auspicious.
But he also saw that.
The king would have broken it because it was something personal against himself.
But he also. This is talked about in the beginning of the next chapter, but. There's Krishna's direct inspiration in there, and also the sage was inspired to allow Krishna's will to go on. He recognized that this is Krishna. So sometimes we think, if I was in that situation, this is how I think it, a better way it should be organized and run. But that thought is also coming from Krishna. But in this case, those thoughts didn't come from Krishna. In the case of Maharaj Prickett, Samik Rishi, or in Sringi, they had different inspirations. They had a completely different consciousness than ours. Let's see if we have more to say about that in the next class. Here's one thing that from the next chapter. Both Samik Rishi, the incident for the king's... Samik Rishi sent news to the king that foolish Sringi, his son, although a powerful Brahmin boy, unfortunately had misused his spiritual power by cursing the king unwarrantedly. The incident of the king's garlanding the Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death. But since there was no way to retract the curse, the king was informed to prepare for death within a week. So he's saying he couldn't retract it there. Both Samak Muni and the king were self-realized souls. Samak Muni was a mystic and Maharaj Pariksit was a devotee. Therefore, there was no difference between them in self-realization. Neither of them was afraid of meeting death. Maharaj Pariksit could have gone to the Muni to beg his pardon, but the news of imminent death was conveyed to the king with so much regret by the Muni that the king did not want to shame the Muni further by his presence there. He decided to prepare himself for his imminent death and find out the way to go back to Godhead. So just by those little hints, we see that there was such a different dynamic, a cultural, spiritual dynamic at work, that here we are, 5,000 years later in Kali Yuga, it's very difficult to understand, well, why didn't they do that? Why didn't he just go to the temple and do that? Why didn't he, you know, go to Kmart and buy something? Or why didn't... You know, we live in a whole different cultural frame of reference. Yeah.
There's one paper here where it explains that the Rishi, he understood that this was a great offense against the pure devotee, and that the only way to avert an offense against the pure devotee is only the Lord can do that himself. That's why he prayed to the Lord.
Yeah. That was the offense of doing it, but how about the curse part of it?
The
curse is different from the offense in one sense, because he could have removed the curse, but he'd have to get Maharaj Pariksit's forgiveness to remove the offense. Anyway, Hare Krishna. So next Wednesday we'll continue. Srimad Bhagavatam.